This is Stories of Win, where we showcase amazing women in neuroscience. We chat with them about their research, their unique journeys through academia, and what drives their passion for studying the brain. Here is one of their stories.
Hello everyone, this is Margarida from Stories of Win, and I have the pleasure today of interviewing Dr. Sepide Keshvarzi. Dr. Sepide is an assistant professor and principal investigator at the University of Cambridge in the UK, and the Keshvarzi Lab studies the neural node underpinnings of the sense of self-motion and orientation in space. Thank you so much for being here with me today.
Thank you, Margarida. Thank you very much for the invite. It's a pleasure.
It's a great pleasure to have you. So we like to start the podcast by asking people, when did you first get interested in the brain and in neuroscience?
Oh, very good question. Sometimes I ask this myself. So actually, I'm a bit late. So let me just say I was born and raised in Iran, and I went to university to study medicine. And there the program is, at least the one I was in, it was one of the best medical training program in the country, but it's also very long. So you don't have, like some other countries, the possibility that you go for a four-year undergrad and then you decide. It was a 7.5-year program. And during this whole time, I was not at all thinking about neuroscience. It was more maybe close to the end that because I was interested in exploring some aspects of clinical research, I approached some faculty members who were working with in neurosurgery department, and then through them I got introduced to some faculty members who were working at more basic science level, like an epilepsy. And it was more during this placement, it was actually after my degree that was I was in this lab as a more like a visiting researcher, that I realized I really like the basic science approach and working in the lab and doing experiments, even though it was very rudimentary at the time. And so despite the fact that at that time, I was preparing for exams to go and continue in medicine and become a specialist, and I wanted to go to the States and take those medical board exams, I projected myself in the future being a doctor, you know, as a career, and I realized I would probably get bored because I like new things. I realized what I had really enjoyed during my, especially medical training, the part where we worked as a junior doctors, because it was part of the degree to actually work as junior doctor. I realized I liked the novelty and I liked the new things where I was learning, both in terms of the things that you learn to do with hands, like the surgical techniques, etc., but also the theoretical foundation. So I realized that I may not get the same sort of excitement as things go forth. And so I decided to explore the whole field of doing research in neuroscience. And I thought I will just try and see how I feel about it. Mm-hmm. And then there we go. I'm stuck. So I applied to a PhD in neuroscience in Australia. directly from Iran. There was also reasons for immigration reasons, and the fact that I wanted to immigrate and Australia was a good option at the time. Given my field of study, they were looking for medical doctors, etc. So there is a lot of stories why Australia. But basically, I got into this neuroscience PhD program there that was the opening for continuing to this date.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a long answer to something that could have been very short. But
No, it was a great answer. And in fact, I want to ask you a bit more, because it's true that a lot of people will come either from a medical background or from a biology background. And I think it's always interesting to understand exactly what was fascinating to you. So you were doing research. Can you tell us a bit more about the research that you were doing as part of still your medical training? And then you can tell me a bit about your PhD as well.
I don't think that, I will tell you, but I don't think that research was what piqued my interest. And I will try to answer your question in a more satisfying way. But my research at the time was, it was a very small project. It was an epilepsy model in rats with, injection of pilocarpine. And we wanted to see how a calorie restriction could have neuroprotective effect. So it was a very small, and the fact that it was the first time I actually was handling animals, doing injections, learning to do perfusions, these sort of, you know, techniques that normally if I had gone through maybe training here, I would have learned this as a maybe an undergrad or research technician, research assistant at much earlier stage. So this is the time where I got exposed more to these basic techniques in the lab, and at the time it was new, so it was like, that's cool. But when I was looking for, so what piqued my interest there was the whole process of thinking about the data you collect, try to make sense of it, try to optimize your experiments, the question to further the research project. I like that intellectual part. Maybe that was the part that interested me the most. But when I was looking for PhD projects and the labs, so I was very insisting on the lab that I approached. And it was a lab, the thing that excited me was a hardcore electrophysiology lab. And the reason was that I was actually, before getting to medical school, my strength was in physics and in mathematics. And I would have even like to study pure math. I was very much geeky in those topics. And my teachers kind of deterred me, or people I knew around. They could not have much the vision of what I would have as a career. They would say, oh, you will be a teacher, which is fine, but I didn't want to just be a teacher. So no one had this vision that as in systems neuroscientists, these are actually very much relevant, the math and physics background. So I think the whole electrophysiology field interested me because it had that element of what I used to like from high school. And I could now mix it with biology. So that's
that's super interesting. That's incredibly interesting. I don't think I ever heard that perspective. It's interesting that you chose not to go for science and meaning mathematics or physics, and then chose medicine, and then found your way back, but with a twist, and going for neuroscience. And so what did you end up doing during your PhD?
My PhD, the project was about understanding olfactory processing circuits in the amygdala. So this was basically all in vitro approaches to understand the basically the substrate of the circuit, like the different cell types, their electrophysiology signature, the synaptic input that they would receive from olfactory pathways, and what traditionally would refer to as a pheromonal pathway versus the main olfactory pathway, and how they integrate at the level of individual neurons. So I was doing a lot of patch clamp recording in a slice, also some calcium imaging, and stimulating these different inputs in slice preparation. And together combine it with neural tracing methods to then see where these cells project downstream in hypothalamus. So it was a very, I would say, also new adventure, because I went to a lab who was very much had a history and a lot of contribution in the field of understanding amygdala circuits in the context of fear conditioning. So it was a lab interest in synaptic plasticity. So the focus was on the fear conditioning circuit that involves the basal lateral amygdala and central amygdala. But where I ended up working was quite different because it was a region in amygdala that was a bit ignored, I would say, in comparison, because it wasn't involved in this fear conditioning paradigms, and it wasn't a hub to study synaptic plasticity, etc. So it was a bit of a black box in terms of knowing its basic circuitry makeup. And so, yeah, I found that aspect quite exciting because, it was everything was new. And yeah, I was thinking through the end to maybe then take it to more in vivo level to now understand what this logic of circuit means for actually olfactory processing and the role of this region in the behavior, etc. But the multiple reasons, including the fact that the techniques I wanted to use, approaches I wanted to use were more inaccessible for this area because it was deep in the brain, etc. And so I didn't go through that direction at the end, but I went to study sensory processing in vivo in other systems.
And how did it feel? Because I guess it's quite a big transitioning going from medical training to research straight to a PhD, and then also moving countries. How did the whole thing feel to you, your whole PhD experience?
Oh, it was crazy. It was terrifying in the beginning. I was hopeless. I think when I started, I really knew nothing. And perhaps this is also, I wonder if Pankaj Saw, my PhD advisor, would ever listen to this. I think because it was established in more senior rep, they could take probably students from wider background. I wouldn't bet on someone with my CV now to enter my lab because I really knew very little. So I had to learn a lot. And so I don't know if this answered your question. I had some struggles also. It was moving country. Everything was new. Everything looked so fancy also where I was working. I didn't know how to operate a lot of the things I was seeing, even the fume hood. So, yes, I had to learn a lot. Yeah.
So it was a big challenge, but I guess, based on how the rest of your career went, that you really liked research and that you were committed to stay on it. And also, you'll tell me about it. So you ended up doing a small postdoc and then still in Australia and then a bigger one in the UK. But before you tell me about that, did you still at this phase where you decided to continue to do research? Did you consider at some point ever going back to just medicine? How did it feel to you?
Yeah, so to be fully honest, when I started, I even didn't think I would necessarily finish a PhD because for me, everything was new and exploration. And I think this was one of the ways I did my whole research career that I would not necessarily advise others, but I was never thinking about my career. You know, I was just driven for a long time, maybe until very recently, about what I liked to do, which is, you know, you can combine that sometimes also with smart decisions about your career. But at the time, I was just thinking, will I like this? And if I don't go far, then I will just get an MPhil. So after, you know, I think it's 2 years that you could get an MPhil instead of continuing to get your PhD and then go back to the initial plan of continuing with my specialty training in medicine. And I never thought again of going back to medicine. And the more I went forward, despite the fact that it was at times really painful, I liked the process so much. I thought that I'm in the right place. Yes.
Mm. Yeah. Research was really what drove you.
And more as I went forward and during my postdoc now, I think I have just progressively realized this is what I should have always done, that actually going to study medicine was a mistake. But I didn't know anything as an 18-year-old, and also being from Iran, no one tells you, unless maybe you're from a very academic family that have better ideas. I mean, I didn't have that. So yes, I didn't think ever to go back.
Interesting. That's very interesting. And so then postdoc was a straightforward decision. So how did it go, and how was the decision? And I also know that you had some constraints. So do you want to tell me about that?
So at the end of my postdoc, at my PhD, in the last year, I actually approached another lab that, you know, I don't need to name whatever it is, to do a postdoc there for, I thought, maybe a shorter postdoc, 2-3 years. Because A, I was interested in their topic. It was closer to what I was doing in terms of technique, also electrophysiology lab, which also had some interest and approaches in vivo technique. So I thought that would be a great place for this transition, because I really knew I want to go and now expand my research into in vivo studies, understanding. So from now going from bottom-up approach to maybe top-down approach. And I got an offer, but I think there was some uncertainty at the time that I didn't understand well. Maybe it was lost in the communication, that the funding actually didn't come true for that lab to offer the postdoc position to me, and I thought I had it. So one of the other reasons I wanted to stay is because, like all of us, we also have personal lives, and I had my partner who I met there, and he was a postdoc, and he was in that also institute, so it would have worked well for us that while I'm finishing that postdoc, he would also finish his, and then we will move together elsewhere. And so when that didn't work out, then I realized, okay, I really need to move forward and go to continue my research in somewhere else. And so I started applying, and because now it was close to the end of my PhD, so we hadn't planned something else also in terms of maybe transition funding in my PhD lab at that point. I was there for a bit, but it wasn't possible to stay any longer. So I was a bit stuck, because I started then applying for positions internationally, and I got some invitation for interview, including from the lab that I ended up doing my postdoc in, Troy Margaris lab at Sainsbury Wellcome Center, UCL. But A, there was a delay with visa, because the visa takes a long time, especially if you have certain passports. And then the whole process was lengthy. And then there was another issue, that I had been in Australia for years, and because of all the trouble I had with my passport, I really wanted to make sure that I get my immigration status there at least. So I have a permanent resident state from somewhere that facilitates a bit my travel, and I don't have to go through these troubles of visa, etc., as much. And so I knew I had to stay another couple of months to a year, and that's where I was not sure what to do. But I was very lucky and fortunate that Professor Greg Stewart, who was at Canberra at the time, he offered me to go in his lab for, you know, a few months to also learn these new in vivo techniques and maybe contribute to some of the research that they were exploring at the time. And so this is what happened. It was basically a good fit at the time. We both knew that it's going to be a temporary position, because I was already interviewing with labs here and also in Germany at the time, and also in America, which is something else that happened at the end. So this is how I ended up in Greg's lab. And this is how then I left after just 9 months, and then I moved to the UK. But also at the time when it was, because you asked what was the troubles on the way. So one of the positions I was interested in was a lab in New York. So I also had an interview there. I had an interview here in London, and two actually here, and then there was also one in Germany. So I had planned this whole trip together to go from all the way Australia to visit these labs. And my American visa never arrived. So I had to cancel that trip. And I decided at that time that I would have troubles if I take a postdoc in the States. My parents are getting old. I knew that the visa will be one way, even if I get it and I start a position there. So if something happens to my family and I go back to visit them back home in Iran, then I may get the visa to come back to the States and continue my postdoc months and months later. And I didn't want to be kind of this, in a way, hostage in a place because I couldn't get out. So that's how I then decided. It basically delayed my postdoc for a year and a half from when I finished my PhD to sort all these things out. Yeah.
Yeah, that's unbelievable. And it's something that more and more people talk about, the different limitations that people experience from several nationalities. And it's really impactful in people's careers, sometimes even for conferences. I'm guessing maybe you've experienced this as well.
Yeah, this was another thing. Yes. Sorry, you wanted to ask something else.
No. I mean, in the end, do you feel like this small delay was manageable and that it did not impact your career that much? Or do you think that this was something that was problematic?
I mean, if you ask me now where I am, it's easy for me to say it was not problematic because I got a, you know, independent position in a competitive place, etc. But before I get it, I was very worried about the way my CV may be assessed in terms of, for example, securing my own postdoc fellowship. Because, you know, a lot of postdoc fellowships also are time dependent. So you have a limited amount of time from when you finish your PhD to when you can apply to those. And I really could only apply for one of them and just once. Also part of it because of the timing. Another thing was at the time, there were also more limitations, for example, in the UK about where you had done your study or where you was your nationality to be eligible for some. But so this was a big worry for me. Mm-hmm. The delay was a big worry for me because I was like, people are going to look on my CV and say, oh, you got your PhD ages ago. Like, what are you doing now? And it did at the end limited the options I had for funding applications. But well, I think I was also lucky that here in the UK, there was a funding body, for example, Wellcome Trust, who is trying to push these boundaries and put maybe rates some other places. So that worked out for me. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to tell everyone that it will work out and it's okay. So
sure. Sure, it's incredibly tough. So maybe we can go back a bit to more to the research side. So after you did your small postdoc with Professor Greg Stewart, you went to the Sainsbury to work with Troy Margrie. And do you want to tell us about that? Because that was quite a long postdoc, which was also incredibly productive.
So, yes. Yeah, so, I actually, the lab was initially in north of London in Mill Hill. It was part of the NIMR that then they moved and became the Crick Institute. So, the lab was originally there. So, one of the things that happened also in the middle of my postdoc or 2 years into postdoc is that we moved labs to Sainsbury Wellcome Centre. So I joined Troy's lab initially because I wanted to study multisensory integration. I knew that I wanted to study this in vivo. I was at the time when I applied, wanted to apply the techniques I knew, like patch clamp techniques in vivo and imaging. So I never did the patch clamp recording in vivo at the end. My project went to more like larger scale population level imaging and electrophysiology. But yeah, so one of the things is that I would say my postdoc, so the question we were addressing was to begin with, we knew very little about how the vestibular signals are processed in the cortex and also combined with other senses like vision. And we know that these are very important for perception of self-motion and also for spatial navigation. And this field had been studied to a much greater extent in primates and in humans, but comparatively, we knew very little about it in rodents. I mean, we knew nothing about this, very limited at the like circuit level in the rodent brain. And this was a big gap because at the same time, a lot of work on the whole navigation, you know, circuits and neural basis of spatial navigation had been identified in the rodent's brain, like with place cells, grid cells, head direction cells, which are very much head direction cells dependent on vestibular signals. So it was this kind of a gap, and I think it was a good time to jump into this field and try to now apply the methods that was used maybe before in primates, both in terms of behavior, some of the colleagues in the lab were focused on, and also in terms of neural recording. So the first thing I was trying to establish in the lab was to image neurons in this part of the cortex called the retrosplenial area, which is a key part of also navigation system. And it was identified that they send the massive projection to the visual cortex. So there was this hypothesis that they probably can, it's well placed, this area, given its connection with the head direction system, to provide vestibular signal to visual cortex and where they can be integrated to, for example, separate own motion from a motion in the external world. So the approach that we thought could be used was to image the cells in retrosplenial that were projecting to visual cortex under the two-photon microscope while presenting natural vestibular stimulus to the animal, which means rotating them in the darkness. So that was a very challenging technically because it had to be using this imaging technique, which is the two-photon microscopy. At the time, there was no, now there's developing a head-mounted two-photon scope. There was no such thing at the time. So stationary objective, rotating the mouse under it, and then derotate the images, etc. So, of course, all of these were very collaborative projects, but I mean, I had to be the one to drive them, to find the problems, etc. And this took a long time. I think one of the parts that perhaps lengthened my postdoc the most was this project, the first one, that then we had a neuron paper from this one in 2018. And we did find, indeed, there were a large number of cells in the retrosplenial area that were showing modulation of their activity with this vestibular stimulation. And they were the ones projecting to V1 because we had tagged them with a rabies virus that we could then know that they're connected. After that, then again, another venture, which was part of my second project, which was again more or less new in the field. It was very new. It was that I got involved with now looking in retrosplenial cortex using electrophysiology with this. Now it was at the developing phase neuropixels probes, and both in the acute preparation, so using the same setup that I was explaining, rotating the animal and then recording from the brain to see the responses of these neurons, and also with and without visual stimulus to see how they can combine the two. But also in freely moving animal to then see how what we find in head fixed animal relates to what actually happens in animal during navigation and in freely moving, exploring an environment. And so this was, again, new techniques because the use of neuropixels probe was new at the time. Also, implementing it in freely moving animal was new. Also, linking data from head fixed to freely moving was, you know, quite new, I would say, there. So I think this was perhaps one of the parts that made my postdoc quite long. And then it was obviously COVID. through the end, I should say I was very lucky that the lab I was in was supportive enough that the last year of my post, I was basically focused on writing my grants, and, you know, I wasn't involved much with the experiments directly, doing some data analysis, but not really that much deeply into the postdoc experiments.
No, but I mean, it's true that it's, while it was a long postdoc, as you were saying, it's such a combination of different challenging techniques altogether, plus the novelty of the research topic that you were focusing on, that in the end, I really think that it's such great work that what you did. And I was wondering, so because your motivation in the beginning and you were telling me was how research work and how thinking about projects and thinking about questions. And then in the end, you were also wanting to do in vivo, which you did with this project, quite a bit of it. So I'm guessing it was a continuously reinforcing thing for your passion for research and in vivo studies.
And especially, I would say, also the novelty aspect that you mentioned and kind of pushing this front in the things we can do in the field, and pushing the boundaries. I think that's what is exciting.
And so would you say right now, because, well, now you've you have your own lab, and we'll go talk about that, but you are continuing to investigate these line of research, and would you say that what drives you now is going to is continuing to pursue this question and this new field, or is it the techniques, or is it both? So what drives your passion currently for research?
I think currently the questions are what excites me the most. I would definitely like to think that we can use new tools and methods to, again, answer the questions and push the boundary. I don't see myself, actually, I don't think I would ever say I am a technique person. I think what excites me the most is the question I see. Techniques can be really cool tools to answer the questions that you cannot otherwise, you know. Did I answer your question?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And so, then you were telling me already that you started applying for grants. And this, I was also asking you this because one of the things that I like to ask people sometimes is whether what was their motivation to becoming a group leader? And was it an obvious next choice? Because some people like doing research because, you know, they like doing the techniques, they like the day-to-day job. And some other people really like the fact that being a group leader, being a PI, enables them to answer their own questions. Mm-hmm. So I'm guessing maybe this is more the second choice for you, or what is it to you that motivates you?
Yes. So part of it was that I should say, again, when I mentioned that I wasn't good at career planning, this was also one of them. When I started my postdoc, I thought I want to have my lab, but I had a more vague idea of why. I think I knew that, you know, this is what you do. You do a postdoc and then you have your lab to answer your own questions. But I hadn't given it too much thought. And I was still open to the idea because I wanted to explore how I feel about doing this now, this new adventure, this postdoc. I wanted to see how I evolve with time. And then it was a point when I thought, oh, actually, what if I can just do this and have my own also idea and follow them? And so I wasn't there for 100% said that I'm going to open my lab at some point. And it became more and more evident when I realized actually the best way to be able to pursue your own idea, to maybe have control in a way of all aspects of it, from the management part to, you know, all the things that is related to how then we want to do the research, how we want to share the results, what type of research environment we want to build, what do we want to contribute to the whole community. I think all of it, I realized this would fall more in the leadership roles that I thought then I definitely need to go to that direction, that there is not much really in between.
That's very interesting. And so you started applying and you got a position recently, actually, this year, as a group leader and an assistant professor in the University of Cambridge. And so how has that transition been? Because it's quite a recent one.
I think the first year, so I mean a few months since opening the lab, is very overwhelming because lots of things are new. Everything is new. It's a very different role, you know. I hope I can do experiments again. So it's a very different role. There is lots of course, emails and admins and all that involved. We also do a bit of, you know, we have part of our role is also teaching. And I wasn't like sure about that before because I was always just a researcher. And I thought maybe this is something I will struggle with a bit more or struggle liking more. But I should say, at least for now where I am, I discovered that I like this part. I like the contribution to, you know, the academic development of young people, and some of them go and become scientists. Or maybe it's because we are very good students, so they're exciting to work with. So what I'm trying to say is that everything is new. And especially in the beginning, you have to set everything up. You realize how much the work go to this part. There's a hiring part needs a lot of also effort. So everything is new and challenging, but I would say also exciting.
That's good.
So I enjoy it. I may complain, but I do enjoy it.
That's good. You're just missing the research part, and other than that, you're enjoying.
I'm impatient for that part to come, but I think everyone tells me this is the phase.
Okay. And so what is it that you want to study in your lab as a whole? What is it, the different lines of research? What do you see happening in the next 5 years? Whatever you would like to tell.
So very broad. I think you mentioned also the broad theme of the lab is that to understand the neural basis of self-motion and spatial orientation. So, I mean, part of their work does relate to what I did before with the part related to computation of self-motion. So for that part, I want to dig deeper into the cortical circuits that support computation of self-motion and integrate different types of information from visual and motor and, you know, other systems and vestibular system. And I want to look at different cell types and local circuit and, you know, cortical circuits and how they support this. On the other part, which is a bit more new adventures to, which is very much also linked to self-motion perception, is that I would like to understand how different types of information that is used for sense of orientation reach the navigation system. And I know that the entry to these cortical areas in the navigation system is through thalamus. And while we have some, you know, work going on about, for example, head direction signal in part of thalamus, there's also other parts that we know are directly linked to these areas, like the retrospinal cortex that I was mentioning, that seem to carry information important for orientation to the system and then to other parts of the navigation system. But we don't know the organization and the function of these different thalamocortical circuits. So I want to tease apart these circuits in terms of both their wiring, but also their function. And by function, I mean, how do they contribute to the computations in the cortex? And how do they contribute to behavior? And so for that, we would design tasks to test orientation abilities in the mouse we use as the animal model, both in freely moving animals and also in a more controlled head fixed setup. Where we just simplify the task to just the ability to know how much, for example, the mouse have been turned. And we then use circuit manipulation techniques targeting these different thalamocortical circuits to know how they contribute to these behaviors. And then we want to look deeper into these areas to understand how information is routed by, for example, employing slice electrophysiology technique that then you can look at different source of inputs with this at synaptic level. And the third theme of the lab, which I'm very excited about exploring, and it's again a new adventure, is then to see how these circuits are impacted with aging and why aging, because we know that navigational abilities decline with age, but a lot of the efforts to explain and understand this has focused on the part about the storage and retrieval of spatial information, so the memory aspects, whereas the part about online processing of information, encoding of the navigational information is less explored. So I want to focus on this part, particularly about sense of orientation and self-motion, to see how changes that may occur in these central processing parts in thalamic cortical circuits may contribute to deficits in sense of orientation and self-motion perception that then can lead to navigational deficits.
That's really very interesting and very novel. And I was wondering, would you like to just study normal aging or also eventually a neurogenerative context?
Yeah, of course. So initially, I would like to know with normal aging, but of course, if you want to study normal aging, you would study also pathological aging. So my idea is to study both normal aging and Alzheimer's mouse models. Mm-hmm. The motivation, I should also mention that some of it comes from human studies. We know that with age, there is a progressive loss of vestibular, periphery. So I would then hypothesize that this peripheral loss lead to plastic changes for compensation in these central processing circuits. And that can bring noise to the system and therefore impact the computation of orientation. And so it would be very interesting to see how would this apply not just to normal aging, but also whether it would then be different in pathological models.
That's really, really interesting. It's a really interesting perspective to this new self-motion and orientation research field. And okay, so I think, well, you're really in the beginning and you are describing the challenges also as a new PI, but is there any milestone that you have in your mind that you would like to achieve in the nearby future?
Oh, I want to do experiments.
That's your milestone.
In the nearby future, I think I will celebrate the day when we at least have our the main behavioral setups ready, or because it's a long phase for building this task, these setups, and I would be very happy when we have them ready, and then I would be even happier when we have our first experiments, whether it's going to be behavioral experiments or neurophysiology. I just want to see the day when we are starting with the experiments.
That's good.
I know it's a very low bar, but you know, you're asking a new PI.
No, but I mean, it's interesting. Everyone's response, it's interesting when I ask this question, and I think this is a very cool one, and it also shows how passionate you are about the actual experiments, which is something that when you become a PI sometimes gets tough to manage. So one of the other things that I wanted to ask you, well, you've taken us through all of your career and research. You came from a medical background, you ended up doing research in neuroscience, you've moved across countries with some challenges, and now you're a PI at a very prestigious university. Is there any advice that comes to your mind, whatever it might be related to, for young researchers that want to succeed?
Difficult question. I mean, I think I have definitely many advice, but let me see what I can pinpoint most. So one of the things is I tell anyone who wants to do a PhD or postdoc or coming to this field, I say, I see it kind of like you should have the same sort of passion and drive as you would have as an artist. If you're a musician and trying to get a piece right, you're not going to, even realize the passage of time. I think this is what makes it easier or made me even more natural to do this work. You need to find that passion in you. And if it's not, and if it needs some, you know, force or an external force to make you want to do it, then it's a kind of waste, I think, of time and also especially money, because we are not paid well. So this is one of the things I say to all the young people who want to get into this. We'll really think about whether this is something that drives you naturally, internally. You have the passion for it, like an artist would. And another thing, it is recently someone in their PhD was asking me, what do you think I should develop the first thing through my PhD? And I would say independence. And by independence, it is multiple things. It's about you want to develop your independent critical thinking, independent ideas. So this is something to focus on. A lot of people stress a lot about, a lot of young, researchers stress a lot about the techniques and also the number of papers they will have to publish and where they have to publish. Sure, we need to show, productivity, and we need to become skilled in what we do. But it shouldn't come at the cost of not being able to read widely, understand other researchers, and be able to then become intellectually independent. So I think this part is very important. It kind of sounds obvious, but I think it very much commonly happens that it becomes the last priority in many young researchers' career.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing those two advices. They are very wise and thoughtful as well. And I think we've talked really a lot about different things, and we can finish. But before we finish, I really like asking people something more light and less related to research. So if you'd like to share, what is it something that you like doing in your free time, which right now might be tough with the transition, but...
Yes, these days it's a bit sad, but I mean, there are the more generic things that I can share and more things that I will do, or I used to do and I will do when I have more time. So the more generic things is I really like to pet my cat, and I like good food and company of, friends, etc. But in terms of, broader things and things that I used to do and hopefully I will do again. I do bouldering and play music. So piano is one of the passions I had for many years. And reading. So these are things that I do to, get past the non-scientific time.
Thank you for sharing that. Well, I think that's it. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today. It was really a great pleasure to hear about you and your career. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.